You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 8th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times.
In the fashionable Dada Lunch District of New York City, on today's program, Alnor Lada, Executive Director of The Rules, explains the Worldverse Bank global action that's going to take place this Friday. It's not only a protest to the World Bank, but a call for a complete reordering of the global economic system. Talking with him. Also,
I will be speaking with Malaya Davis. She is an activist with the Ohio Student Association, and they are currently occupying the Beaver Creek Police Station, looking for justice for John Crawford, the young unarmed black man who was shot and killed in a Walmart in Beaver Creek, Ohio. We will be talking to her literally a few minutes before they get their first demand, and that is a meeting with the Beaver Creek police chief.
More fallout. That'll be fascinating. More fallout. The great Reza Aslan Islam debate continues on the Majority Report. Other places too, but obviously covered best on the Majority Report. Brian Kilmeade, in his own way, I don't know if he knows what a coup is, but it seems like he's getting close to calling for one. And fighting on the Turkish border. ISIS still strong in this town of Kobani. We're going to cover that and the Turkish angle.
Also, Rush Limbaugh has feelings on why Obama isn't doing enough to save us all from Ebola.
What if race has something to do with it?
Yeah. We got tons more, but this one is pretty funny. Something happened to an open carry activist, and you'll have to be a member and hear in the better half of what exactly happened to him, but I promise you it's pretty funny.
That's pretty good.
But we do have some breaking news to report to you this morning.
The first, and I don't have his name in front of me, but the first American, the man in Texas who was diagnosed with Ebola.
Thomas Eric Duncan was his name.
Yeah, he's passed away. If you're listening to live stream, this is new. Presumably, if you're downloading this and listening to this later, you probably would have already known. That's obviously terrible for him and his family. And I think, this is a real public health concern, and then how to address a real public health concern without falling into all of the cynicism and fear-mongering is kind of the question. But we just wanted to note that. Bad news. We are going to take a quick break. Is everything all right over there?
Give me one second.
How much more can I talk about Ebola?
Okay, we're good.
All right, are we good?
Yeah, I just had to check something.
I was gonna about to wheel out an old borscht belt joke, which was totally fun half material.
No, you know, when it's just the two of us, it's a bit that extra person, three people.
I will tell you in the second half, and I'm Jewish. I will do the joke of what the group of middle-aged Jewish ladies who were out for lunch, and what the waiter asked them. So that's coming up on the fun half. All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Alnor Lada. We'll be right back with Al Mourlata.
Yes, we will.
We'll be back momentarily.
I promise
with Al Mourlata.
Here we go. All right.
All right. Are we ready?
Yep. We'll be right back.
Fresh and we're clean, I mean. I burn the stinkest of green, I mean. Better listen up, careful and keen, I mean. I put one as a rock and come in. We celebrate like I finished probation, boy, boy. Not care with no chaser, boy, boy. From the mouth, I can spit out a razor, boy, boy. Open up your facial like your boy, Roy, in his prime. Eat food, dinner time, junior gong, pass the Guinness. Handle business, black velvet, sippers, females never bid us farewell, they with us. Cause we arrive on the scene just like a high beam, nah, I mean. Don't let us have to make the nine scream, nah, I mean. At your racial policing regime, nah, I mean. Spiritual well like an Elohim, nah, I mean. In a casino or got wherever I'm seen, my brothers and sisters are never forgotten, I mean. Don't want to hear another soldier drop, I mean. Another dope addict is shot with the morphine, and feds are indicting my block, I mean. They're wearing reds from their shoes to their top, I mean. I'm wishing that all the violence would stop, I mean. When I like this song, I'm siren, I mean. And some boys soft like ice cream, I mean. From my boy, make the feds intervene, I mean. Wishing I were gonna take him shopping, I mean. Parabellum, them are each up in a spleen, I mean. In a Queen's gunman reigns supreme, nah, I mean. Kingstonians are real blood fiends, nah, I mean. The world is a big crime scene, nah, I mean. Yo, yo, Mr. President.
Yo, Mr. President.
What you doing for my resident?
What you doing with my resident?
Yo, Mr. Minister.
Mr. Minister.
Why you being sinister? Hey. Yo, yo, Mr. President.
Yo, yo, Mr. President.
What you doing for my resident?
What you doing with my resident?
Yo, Mr. Minister.
Mr.
Hey.
Minister.
Why you being sinister?
Someone in a real buffalo in a Rastafari regime. Push bungalow where me dwell with my queen. Trash to the
we are back on the Majority Report.
I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Al Mourlata. He's the executive director of the RULES, a global anti-poverty hub and organization. Al Mourlata, how are you?
Great, Michael. Thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure to talk to you as always, man. So I want to talk, we're going to get to this really, really interesting set of actions that you guys have planned for Friday, sort of in protesting, not just protesting the World Bank, but really outlining a different kind of global vision of how the economy and how society can and should work. But I want to situate where you're coming from before we get there. So the RULES is, I mean, it is an anti-poverty organization, as I said in your intro, but you're looking at things a little bit more fundamentally and a little bit more systemically than we might be used to when we hear the term anti-poverty organization. So explain what the RULES, what you guys are doing, and what the context you're operating under, and how that kind of sets the stage for the actions on Friday.
Yeah, cool. That's a great question. Start big, and then we can get into the details.
Right.
So, you know, we don't even really think of ourselves as an anti-poverty organization in any traditional sense. We think of it as, how do we address the root causes of inequality?
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in the sort of traditional poverty development rhetoric is that they try to separate poverty and inequality. You know, they like to talk about poverty as if it's an end state. You know, some sort of externality that is solvable, but it's not. Poverty is not an end state. It's impoverishment. It's a process, mm-hmm. You know, and it's created and ratified every day by our social, political, economic system, and that's done quite purposefully, and not in the sense of a conspiracy theory, but in the sense of it is the natural, logical outcome of a set of rules that benefits the top 1%. To the detriment of everyone else. And so trade rules and land right rules and rules around climate change that allow rich companies to pollute and spew carbon into the atmosphere, all of these sort of major structures create poverty. And, you know, the thing with inequality and the reason that the even progressive movements don't like to talk about inequality, you know, one could argue they're not progressive if that's the case, but, you know, inequality is a relative thing. And then all of a sudden you need to talk about sort of how society should be distributed and what is fair. And they just want to sort of categorize it as this other thing that can just be solved by more money, you know, raise all boats, you know, all of those old kind of neoliberal tropes.
Yeah, so that's really fascinating. So when you talk about the rules, what you're really getting at is, and in some respects, I mean, obviously there are these very objective conditions that we live under. There's different economic rules. There's technological realities. But at the same time, capitalism is a story, as any other kind of large organizing system. We're living by stories and narratives that we take as, conditioned objective reality. This is the system we live under. 2 + 2 = 4. That's just it. And we need to navigate around that period, even if it's not sort of really working. And I think so. Is that the other part of what you're getting at? There's like the objective process of challenging the policies, but you're using that as a kind of road to question the underlying stories or rules that we're living by, and then in that create space for new ones.
Yeah, that's our highest ideal in many ways. Part of the challenge right now is that we have people who are on a daily basis, the world's majority, I would say 7 out of 8 people are living under $10 a day and directly affected, by the policies of sort of rich Western governments. Their only strategy for growth is, what they call emerging economies. And it's really about the exploitation of the rest of the world, because the West has stopped growing. And even through a sort of credit-based economy, there are limits to that. And so you have to stop the bleeding to a certain extent. But we can't only focus on the kind of reactionary, here's what the World Bank is doing or the IMF is doing. And that's important, as we'll talk about when we get into this campaign. But the reason to do that is also to build power amongst us, to build connections and relationships among progressive/radical social movements around the world, because that's where the power is. And the aim eventually is to then use this power base that's been successful. Just look at what the movement has done since even the 1960s, right? If you think about from civil rights to the feminist movement, to bring it to now to Occupy or Arab Spring and Chilean Winter and Idle No More movement, all of these, there's just been this like exponential rise in the frequency and power and interaction and dynamism of the challenge to power. And so we have to continue to do that. We have to, stop the bleeding. We can't just be in that sort of futuristic utopian, what does the, regenerative society look like, or what does the new economy look like, and sort of forget about the rest. The two have to happen together, and actually they're totally symbiotic, because as we challenge power, we build our own power, and that starts giving us the avenue to then say, okay, we're okay with having some kind of ownership capitalist structure if, they're cooperatively owned and we have checks and balances on these corporations. And then, as we get those sort of wins, and then, we talk about how do we move away from a debt-based economy. But we can't even begin to have those conversations when power is concentrated the way it is.
Right. And we're going to get to the World Bank specifically in just a moment. But I thought that was really interesting because you were, obviously starting in the 60s, but then referencing things like Occupy, the movements of 2011, 2012 in the Middle East, Chile, the African awakenings you could add as well. What I'm wondering, because I think in the traditional narrative, what we sort of get fed as an example was, well, Occupy at best, gave it helped frame the 2012 election potentially, and there was some more broader talk of inequality. The Arab Spring, that's turned to Arab Winter with the kind of growth, disillusion of states and growth of terrorism. But I get the sense from the way you think and how you situate things that even with those countervailing forces and even with those disruptions, that you're still seeing in the longer term, the longer trend, that all of those movements, all of those uprisings are still kind of, they have momentum, even if it's not apparent day to day, and it's still feeding something broader, and that's emerging, that you're pointing to and trying to coordinate in some respects.
No, definitely, definitely. I think the defining battle of our time is corporate globalization versus decentralized social movements, the plutocrats versus the people. And this sort of, this battle, and I hate to use war metaphor, but it's getting intensified in so many ways that the only outcome is going to be a massive tipping point. And, of course, climate change is going to exasperate that tipping point, having the highest levels of inequality known to man. You know, we have 89 billionaires with the same wealth as 3.5 billion people.
Right.
Just think about that. You know, you could put these people on a small jetliner, and they have the same wealth as half the human population. These history is very fragile, and the elites that we have in power, you know, we have rewarded. And this is not to just say, this is not about people. It's about a logic of the system.
Right.
The system has rewarded people that are highly short-termist, highly selfish, highly Machiavellian. You know, that's the rule, the code of the capitalist operating system. And so it's no wonder we have a psychopathic elite. You know, we have to look at these people in power and not see them as you know, people we look up to, but people that we should have empathy for. You know, that in many ways are powerless, and in many ways, like, the system itself, the logic of the system doesn't reward merit, right? These aren't intelligent people. They might be clever in certain ways, in Machiavellian ways. They're not wise.
Mm.
And actually, the people that get rewarded by this system are the people who sort of best perpetuate the logic of the system. And that's what these people are. And so they're doing, you know, there's so many diabolical things happening at that global level. So TPP, the global trade deal that's trying to carve up the world and allow corporations to sort of set the rules, or RED, this UN program, reducing emissions through deforestation. And essentially what it does is it allows corporations to buy massive swaths of land and displace indigenous people and get carbon credits and tax credits in perpetuity.
Right.
You know, even the whole carbon trading scheme is like, how do we create a long-term infrastructure, multi-generational, supranational, it doesn't matter who's in power, because they're desperate, right? So that's happening on one side, this battle. And then on the other, we're seeing all these beautiful sparks. And now we can look at just one of the sparks and try to, you know, create the sort of post-mortem, let's say, you know, for Occupy or the Arab Spring. But why would we analyze that in a bubble? And, you know, part of the reason we do it is because the way we experience history is very immediate, you know, very short. We're here now. We read these daily newspapers. We're inundated with sort of crap that passes for news on the internet and in the media, right?
God.
Yeah. No, but, you know, and who is this media largely owned by, right?
Right?
So, you know, even though we think we're free and independent thinkers, our subconscious and even, you know, our conscious and, you know, even in some precognitive and pre-linguistic ways, we are primed with all sorts of messages around sort of defeat and lack of hope. And, you know, people like Margaret Thatcher are explicit. You know, there is no alternative, her famous female line. There is no alternative. But we're told that in a myriad of other ways,
right?
You know, and we face that power in every way. We get denied for a mortgage. Our kids don't get into the school. You know, there's these daily reminders. They're like landmines all around us that tell us that the only way is this. And it's fundamentally untrue. And so, you know, you mentioned the African awakenings, Michael. And, you know, there's 30-plus African awakenings happening on the continent. They're small in some cases, large in others, popular resistance to the dominant neoliberal paradigm, you know, the Western capitalist model that's being exported everywhere, you know, sometimes at, you know, gunpoint to their head, whether that's structural adjustment programs or loan conditionalities or investment conditionalities or whatever it is. But there is total resistance to that, and they're all connected, right? And the story we're told by the media, so Arab Spring is about some backwards Arabs kicking their hijabs off their women and embracing Western democracy.
Right.
And that's total bullshit. It started with a self-immolation in protest to economic injustice.
Right.
And all of these struggles, even Idle No More, the indigenous, global indigenous struggle that started in Canada, you know, these are all about, they're an expression towards a system that does not benefit the world's majority. And
right.
They're the white blood cells. They're the autoimmune response for a planet that has had psychopaths at its helm for way too long.
And actually, and that's a very important point. I mean, just going very specifically back to Egypt, there's the role of the labor movement in just even a specifically like a city like Alexandria, which obviously is not in Cairo, not in Tahrir Square, was absolutely pivotal to the movement in 2011, and that was not nearly as covered as, you know, the role of tweeting or something like that. So you're absolutely on point with that. Now let's take this to this World Bank action that you have planned. I remember, you know, maybe I was 15, 16 years old. One of the first kind of serious actions I took part in was a World Bank protest, which was a little while ago now, like 2000, 2001, something like that. The World Bank has always sort of been a center for, you know, a vehicle for kind of imposing the types of policies, obviously, that you're talking about in developing countries and across the globe. Why specifically are you focusing on the World Bank, and what are the actions in World versus Bank that you are undertaking? And then after that, we can kind of get to, again, to the alternatives that you're outlining as well.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, part of this came as a sort of response to what a lot of different groups were coming together around. And so, you know, what we tried to do is not go impose our own agenda or put up some, you know, useless petition, but really to respond to the needs of social movements around the world and other, you know, legitimate bodies for the people's voice. And what has happened is that it started very specifically around the World Bank's doing business rankings, which, you know, I don't know how much you know about this.
I've covered that on the show. Yeah, go ahead.
Of course. Yeah. But most people don't know this, that, you know, most people know about the structural adjustment program, where these kind of, you know, these diabolical set of programs that were really pursued in the 80s and 90s that devastated the African continent. There were, you know, a set of, you know, essential mandates on how sovereign governments could run themselves. And they were forced to run themselves in ways that sort of emulated not actually the way the U.S. or the U.K. really run themselves, but in ways that benefited U.S. and European corporations. You know, so they had to cut their health care and their welfare systems and all social
privatization,
security.
Austerity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Privatization, austerity, you know it, right? And, you know, they destroyed the continent. You know, in the 1960s, the African continent, post the various independence movements, was growing at like 4, 5, 6% a year, you know, and then these structural adjustment programs coming in, and the continent was growing at 0.5%, you know, totally directly related. And, of course, the West got massively rich on the back of this. And so in about 99, they were essentially forced to stop. Like the widespread legitimacy of the bank was in total question, as was the IMF, you know, and National Financial Corporation. And, of course, USAID and all these other organs of neoliberal expansion. And so what happened is they said, okay, you know, we'll take these away. And, of course, a couple of years later, in 2002, they rolled out the Doing Business ranking, mm. which sound very benign. Because their rankings, and, you know, as all the kind of Orwellian tricks that imperialists use, what they did was they essentially created this non-voluntary ranking system that happens by a bunch of technocrats in D.C., and they rank every country on the world on, you know, how easy is it to fire labor, how easy is it to pollute their environment, what's their relationship with tax havens, how easy is it to extract wealth from that country, and then do these rankings, and then essentially tie their loans or their investment projects or even their, you know, involvement in countries onto, you know, how willing they are for these reforms. And they don't hide these things. You know, it's the flagship program of the bank. They take great pride in saying that, you know, 40% of the reforms on the African continent have happened as a result of these rankings, and it's probably much more. Right. You know, and so groups were coming together, and we said, okay, let's reanimate the fight against the bank, because it's sort of languished in the last 10 years or so. They haven't been the target. There's been so many other enemies. And we're like, this is a great moment. And so last March, April, we sort of started this campaign called Our Land, Our Business, working with 230 different social movements and civil society organizations around the world. Put this back on the map as, you know, you haven't taken away the structural adjustments. The new shock doctrine are the Doing Business rankings, and we want the abolition of these rankings. And, of course, most people in the group and you know, anyone who understands power wants the abolition of the bank itself, but we have to start somewhere, and this is a great entry point, which is it shows how undemocratic, how plutocratic, how elitist, how pro-corporate, and how anti-poor the bank really is, so that's the essential demand of this campaign. And World versus Bank is basically the doubling up of that effort. It's all of these groups who, you know, discussed these things with the bank. They showed their banality of evil in those discussions. And now it's the people are taking it to the streets. So So it's going to be 12 cities, simultaneous, what we're calling creative resistance. So poets, spoken word artists, musicians. So it's not angry lefties just protesting. We're showing the sort of beauty of the resistance, you know, and just basically allowing the bank to know that we know the emperor has no clothes. We know that you pretend to be a development organization and you're really an organ of neoliberal wealth extraction. And so that's one level, is this 12-city simultaneous creative resistance. The second is we're doing a missed call campaign, which allows anybody with a first-generation basic phone, mobile phone, to dial into these local numbers as their petition. So if they don't have internet or a laptop or whatever, which, you know, most places in the global south don't, and even places like India only have a 12% internet penetration rate. So we're allowing sort of wide-scale kind of populist legitimate expression, and we're going to deliver that, those, you know, we're hoping it'll be a million-plus calls in 15 to 20 countries. And we're going to deliver those petitions, that voice, to the bank on Friday. And then there's also the Oakland Institute, which is one of the leading land rights think tanks in the world. We're releasing an amazing piece of research, landmark study that's coming out on Friday around the effects of the bank's policies, especially around land and agriculture, how they've enabled widespread land grabbing and the move to monoculture, destroying diversity of food crops, and also the livelihood of smallholder farmers around the world. They played a central role in that. So all of these different elements, you know, coming together at the same time is sort of, you know, the first time this type of organizing at this transnational level is happening in a while. And we were just, you know, honored to be part of that resurgence.
Absolutely. And, you know, before we close, and I'll be following this, and I'm sure everybody listening and watching will be following this really closely, and I'll be writing about this more, in fact, as you know. But, you know, it occurs to me that part of, I think, the product of all of this discussion and all of these movements and all of the things that are at stake is it's really about reclaiming and rearticulating commons, whether it's in culture, whether it's in technology, art, environment, that there has to be these spaces that supersede state power or market power, and that are really a broader common heritage. And that's really fundamentally what's not only what's totally under threat, but also a very the kind of basis of a really different way of looking at prioritizing and organizing things. And I think one of the reasons that I have such appreciation and respect for what you're doing is you're enacting that through the rules and through just kind of allowing these movements that already are existing independently and flourishing to connect and see each other.
Thank you for that, Michael. Yeah, and I think you're totally right in that, and these elites have forgotten, you know, why they're in power in the first place, right? So government rule now is just corporate rule, and they're only in power, they only exist because we allow them to, you know, and their role is to serve our interests, and they fundamentally do the opposite. So I think this is a great moment, and if anyone wants to get involved, go to ourlandourbusiness.org. And always feel free to check out www.therules.org.
Absolutely. Alnor Lada, Executive Director of The Rules and a good friend. Very glad to have you on, Alnor. Thanks so much, man.
Pleasure, Michael. Thank you so much.
Take care. Cheers. Bye-bye. All right, folks.
Do you ever have anyone on that isn't a good friend? I feel like you say that every time.
I'm like a politician. It's my good friend, Alnor Lada. I'm not above hitting the looking at my text history when looking
just
for a guest.
I'm poking fun with you, Michael.
Not above that.
Michael's a very connected individual.
I have a lot of friends. Okay, so what we got? We got like a minute here to chat, and then you should get this person on the phone.
Yeah.
No, I think that this action is going to be really amazing. I'm actually writing a piece for Good that will go up, I think, on Friday about the missed call piece. Missed calls are fascinating because basically what they do is they function like basically like text messages in developing countries. You can use it to kind of because you don't get charged because nobody picks up. So you can use it as like, you know, like a code, like I'm going to be there in 5 minutes or I'm running late type of thing. And then in 2011, these Indian anti-corruption activists started using it to register public support for this anti-corruption drive. And then Al Noor and the guys he works with created something called, I think it's called Crowd Ring, that actually helps, you know, aggregate these calls, and that's what they're using for the World Bank action. So that's pretty cool.
Let's switch.
All right, let's switch it up. You got your music lined up?
Yeah, we're ready to go. Coming up next, when we're back from the short break, I'll be speaking with Malaya Davis of the Ohio Student Association. They are down at the Beaver Creek Police Station, where they've been occupying the station, demanding justice for John Crawford. And I believe in about 30 minutes, they'll be getting their meeting with the police chief of Beaver Creek. So should be interesting to hear from them just minutes before. We'll be right back.
Yo.
All right, we are back on the Majority Report. Joining me now, she is the Northeast Ohio Regional Director with OSA, the Ohio Student Association, which can be found at ohiostudentassociation.org. Malaya Davis. Malaya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us. I mean, should be said right before we go into the interview is that you are about less than 25 minutes away from getting the meeting that you and your activists have been demanding from the police chief of Beaver Creek in Ohio.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So let's get right to it. You've been occupying the Beaver Creek, Ohio police station for how many days now?
This is our third day.
Third day, great. And how many people have been occupying the police station?
We've had at least 25 people have a presence at the police station at a time. And so, you know, which is a pretty large number for Beaver Creek, Ohio, and it's pretty big given the space that we are allotted.
And let's get, go back even further a bit. We've been talking about what happened to John Crawford, the unarmed young black man who was shot and killed by Beaver Creek police in Walmart for ostensibly holding a product that the Walmart sells, the BB gun. And this happened because apparently there was an individual who called the police and told them there was a man holding a gun inside Walmart threatening people. And police showed up and shot John Crawford. And then only afterwards did they discover he was holding what is essentially not a lethal weapon whatsoever. So what sparked your interest in this case?
Well, Ohio Student Association is a statewide network of young organizers in Ohio. And so we have folks that are part of OSA from Beaver Creek and that attend Wright State University, which is around the corner from the Walmart where John was killed. I also attended Wright State University. And so that is a portion of what really brought me to this case. I felt a responsibility to respond to what happened, being that, you know, I went to the school around the corner and shopped at that Walmart frequently. Mm-hmm. You know, my classmates shopped at that Walmart. And, you know, being that I am a young black woman, I can be racially profiled. I can be criminalized, which is what often happens to black bodies in this country. And I couldn't have been deemed suspicious for anything that I could have done. And so just thinking that, you know, myself or my classmates, my peers, my friends that all frequent this Walmart, we could have been John Crawford. And so, like I said, I felt responsible to respond to this and to hold someone accountable for taking this young man's life.
I mean, we've been seeing what's been happening in Ferguson with the protests in response to the killing of Michael Brown. So what is there? I mean, usually this is the case, but is there a historic tension between police and the black community in Beaver Creek, Ohio?
Well, Beaver Creek, Ohio is a majority white suburb of Dayton, Ohio.
Okay,
and so. Yeah, the community to law enforcement relations in Beaver Creek are typically pretty good.
Mm. So when you decided to occupy you and the Ohio Students Association decided to occupy the Beaver Creek Police Office. What was the plan for that? Why occupy the police station?
Well, we've been organizing around the Justice for John Crawford movement from the beginning, ever since we, you know, found out about what happened. Like I said, we have people who are from the area who, you know, have some real skin in the game for this case. So we hosted vigils in the beginning of August, like I said, right around the time he was killed. We led silent marches to the Beaver Creek Police Station to hand deliver letters for them to release the surveillance tape, if not to the public, at least to the parents of John Crawford. Mm-hmm. We got that demand the day after we asked for it. And our Attorney General, Mike DeWine, he summons a grand jury to meet September 22nd through the 24th, and we organized folks to come down to Greene County and partake on an 11-mile pilgrimage from the Walmart where John was killed to the Greene County courthouse. And so once we found out about the verdict not to indict Officer Sean Williams, which was the officer who killed John, we decided that it was time to, you know, escalate the situation and really show the power that we have as a statewide network. And it just as concerned young people from across the state. And so, you know, at that moment, we knew that that next step was some type of nonviolent direct action. And, we thought a lock-in at the police department would be, you know, the most strategic thing to do at that point.
And you have a list of three demands that you'll be presenting mm-hmm. to the police chief when you meet with him in about 20 minutes. So what are those three demands?
Yeah, so the three demands we have, we're redirecting them as questions so that he can give us, you know, clear yes or no responses.
Mm-hmm.
And so those demands that we are turning into a question is, what will happen to Officer Sean Williams? What will happen to the 911 caller Ronald Ritchie? And do you agree that the training material that was issued by our state's Attorney General, Mike DeWine, that is being used in this case needs to be overhauled? And so those are the three demands that we are going to be asking in question form. And we hope that the outcome of this meeting is, you know, in both of our favors.
And after this meeting with the police chief, what is the next step for justice for John Crawford? What do you feel the Ohio Student Association's next steps will be?
Mm-hmm. So, well, after this meeting, we'll determine, you know, whether we, you know, decide to stay here longer, whether we decide to leave. But for sure, we know that we're going to be having a mass mobilization on the 18th of October in Columbus, Ohio. And the purpose of this event is really to take this conversation to a broader scale. You know, our meta narrative is that we want to fundamentally shift the relationship and power dynamics between law enforcement and community. And we know that, you know, police brutality in the Black community and on, you know, Black bodies is a systemic issue that needs national attention. It's not just about John Crawford and Beaver Creek or, you know, Mike Brown and Ferguson, but it's an issue that happens all over our state. And how do we begin to really talk about it in that way and build a movement from there? Also, on the 25th of October, we're asking people around the state of Ohio to vote early on the same day together. Because the reason why we want this to happen is we want, you know, like I said, we want to shift that relationship between law enforcement and community. And the reason we say law enforcement, because that can range from the police officer, the county sheriff, or the county prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And some of those, you know, positions are elected by citizens. And so we want, you know, our elected officials to know that we are not going to stand by, you know, any longer and twiddle our thumbs and let you decide things for us. And we're voting so that we don't have to ask you questions about, are you going to fire someone who, you know, unlawfully killed someone and there's no consequences for it, you know?
Absolutely. Yes. So, What has been the, because you had mentioned previously that Beaver Creek is a suburb of Dayton, and Beaver Creek usually has a predominantly white community, has a good rapport with the police precinct and the police officers. So what has been the response from the community to the actions demanding justice and accountability for the death of John Crawford?
We've actually gotten overwhelmingly positive response from a lot of Beaver Creek residents. We've gotten tons of, you know, food and donations, so much food that we actually had to give it away to the people who were coming to stay with us. But it's just been, you know, awesome to know that we have the blessing of the residents here and that we have their support. And, you know, for the residents of Beaver Creek who don't agree with what we're doing, we haven't heard and or seen from them, so, you know, we really don't want to focus our attention too much that way.
Malay Davis, it's great work what you've been doing. The lock-in at the police station is genius because, I mean, what can they do? I mean, either way, you're getting the press to justice for John Crawford, regardless mm-hmm. of whether, I mean, because I assume you thought that there could be a chance that on that first day when you didn't leave, they might have arrested you. Am I correct?
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, either way, it's a win for you guys because you guys are getting that attention to this issue. I think in the mainstream news coverage, what happened to John Crawford was disgustingly undercovered, and I think the least we can do for this, what happened to this poor man, is get him justice and make sure this never happens again and hold the people responsible, mm-hmm. who I think in this case are the police officers involved with this shooting, like you said, the officer mm-hmm. Sean Williams, who is directly mm-hmm. responsible. But I also feel like there should be some sort of accountability for the 911 caller. What was his name
Absolutely.
Again?
Ronald Richey.
Ronald Richey, yes. Because, yes. I mean, even though he's not the one who pulled the trigger, he reported what was he was seeing in a way that made the police believe they were entering a dangerous, life-threatening situation, which is a false police report in my mind. And I'm glad right. and I'm glad that you guys added that to this issue, because it's something that I feel like many people, when they're discussing this case, they just bring up, oh, Sean Williams wasn't indicted for the Williams shooting on September 24th, mm-hmm. and that's the end of that, nothing we can do. I still feel like there's things that can be done, and you guys are directly making sure that those issues are still out there, and I can't thank you enough for the great work you're doing. Good luck with your meeting with the police chief in about 10 minutes now, and I hope he gives you some answers, and I think you guys are certainly changing minds. Even if you don't get what you want out of him, you've certainly done so with the broad public.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, you too.
That's...
Activism is good.
Yeah, I mean, today's show, activism, you know?
Today's show is an activism show, no doubt.
I mean, you can make a difference, and I know people get disheartened. And I know, I mean, on this show, I guess the movement we covered more than anything was Occupy.
Right.
And I mean, you can see it right here. Lock-ins aren't anything new. But would this thing have been covered if all of a sudden when occupations – and I'm not saying Occupy is the reason for it in general. Occupy is just American mainstream news coverage's way of now classifying these sorts of things. But I mean, you realize now that ever since that broad movement – and it started in Spain, I believe – with the Los Indignados, if I remember correctly. And, you know, there's something about this sit-in, this occupation, we see are seeing it in Hong Kong right now. I mean, protests have been going on for decades, and different types of protest strategies have garnered more coverage than others throughout history. And right now we're seeing that if you can get a large group of people to shut down an area, whether it's as small as a police station or as big as the largest streets in Hong Kong, you can get that attention that maybe holding up a sign at the end of your block for a few hours or having a police-sanctioned march where they plan out the routes. You know, this is what's getting coverage in the news. And it's that simple. I mean, how many people showed up at that People's Climate March?
Thousands, tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands, definitely.
And what, it got maybe like a 2-minute, 3-minute discussion in the mainstream coverage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sad that that happened. But at the same time, how many people occupied Wall Street? How many people sat in Zuccotti Park? Maybe a few hundred. How long did that get covered for? How much coverage did that get? I mean, do what you got to do. It's all about the protest strategy and movements that are we're currently seeing. And my hearts go out to the people down in Beaver Creek right now. I think what they're doing, I mean, to occupy a police station, that takes
a lot of chutzpah.
Takes, yes. Jeez.
A lot of chutzpah. So, folks, before we go into the fun half, you can support the show that supports the movement. Become a member of the Majority Report today at, what is the site again?
JoinTheMajorityReport.com.
JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Less than a cup of coffee a day. If you're going to buy something through Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link. That's a no-brainer. Costs you nothing extra, but cuts into Amazon just a little bit and tithes us. You get to spend some of your money wisely or effectively for the Majority Report. If you buy it through our Amazon link, follow us on Twitter at majority.fm. Like us
no,
on
Facebook. No, just
at
majority.fm.
Excuse me, at majority.fm. My mistake. Like us on Facebook and, you know, check us out because we post YouTube videos there. That's a great way of pushing content, getting your friends and social circles to know about the show.
You know what? I think we're at like, 7,000-something Facebook followers, much lower than our Twitter followers. So let's get us to 8,000 this week.
Yeah, let's get us to 8,000. Go on Facebook, like the Majority Report Facebook page. Start using it. There's discussions. There's common threads. That's people are on it. It's a great way to join the conversation. Subscribe to our YouTube channel.
At youtube.com/SamSeder. And then there's the live channel where you can watch this full show live right now at youtube.com/MajorityReportLive. Leave us a review on iTunes, please.
Indeed.
It really helps. Someone actually took a screenshot at the end of last week, and we were moving up the rankings. We were in like the What's Hot section next to all these other big political podcasts. That's how people discover us. It's that simple. You leaving a 5-star review, 4-star review, however you feel, and leaving a little text comment. This show is great. I listen to it every morning. Can't start my day without it. Sam Seder is great. Matt and Mike are even better. You know, things like that. It helps people say, I'm going to try this podcast out. Really. It's
and as
simple.
You know, this podcast really does have a unique place in this whole world. I think there's definitely some things we do that other shows don't do, and we do them well. And we appreciate every bit of support we get. JustCoffee.coop.
Use coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off your order. Fair trade, coffee and chocolates. DonateYourAccount.com. Go there. Click the Majority Report campaign. You could donate your Twitter and Facebook account with the click of a button. What that means is basically we don't have your password or anything like that. You simply connect your account, and then once a day we will send out one video or podcast show. No advertisements, just a clip, content from the show through your Facebook and Twitter feed so your friends and followers can see it, comment on it, watch it, like it, spread the word. That's what it does. That's our better half show. That's our first half show of today.
We're going to be up.
Better
we'll
half's
be right
coming
back.
Up. Sam will be live tomorrow from Vegas. He will be doing the show tomorrow and Friday. We will see you in the better half. Take care.